after I was born, my mother wrote that she waited 2 years for a manifestation that did not come. Eventually, she left me on the stairs of the church wrapped in blankets. She pounded on the door for hours, even as I wailed. They ignored her pleas. Finally, as a bald priest angrily flung open the rectory door, light flashed from a bassinet. She took it as a sign and brought me back home. I read this in her diary, and I remember when she saw me on the kitchen windowsill, changing from a boy to a cat and back to a boy. She did not tell me to stop. She did not act surprised. Instead, she held me close, kissed me hard on the forehead, and bade me never make her mistake. Always remember to think twice. Always think twice. I think of her often as I practice. After all, it was her dance, the dance she taught me, the dance she said I was born to do. Over and over again, the dance on the floor in the round. She said I'd be the one who could dance on the floor in the round. The dance of power, strength, joy. But if I made her mistake, if I felt a temptation, the dance would mean my ruin. She was my mother, so I listened, but I didn't understand. I grew. I practiced. Day after day after day, mother's dance became my dance. I felt myself getting closer to the source, the beginning, the magic, this light, power. It followed me, became my companion. That's when I met her, like a beauty queen. Turned every head with eyes that dreamed of being her one. So strange our meeting. I thought I kept secrets, but she stared at me and I knew, she knew, that I was the one who could dance on the floor in the round. I ran from her then, because I was so close to doing what mother could never do. I returned to mother to see if I could find a way out, but she told me you could never love anything but the dance. Be careful what you do. From this point, your lies become a truth. Afterward, I felt stalked. But perhaps I was the hunter. Maybe deep down, I needed someone to know that I was the one. Yes, we danced together once. She shrieked in a magic dark madness and vanished. For 40 days and for 40 nights, it was as if she didn't exist. I pretended she didn't until I heard the pounding. The screaming, I opened the door to the night. At first, I saw nothing, but looked down to hear wailing from the bassinet. I saw her then in the shadow, smiling. Look at him, she said. Is your child not beautiful? I snatched back the blanket. My own eyes stared back at me. Witch! What sorcery is this? As light flashed from the child's bassinet, she laughed that he was the one who would dance on the floor in the round. Today, on Snap Judgment, from WNYC, we proudly present Man in the Mirror. Amazing stories from people meeting themselves for the very first time. My name is Glenn Washington. jam on, because you're listening to Snap Judgment. Now then, we're going to kick off the snap with a story of amazing talent. Tristan R. Whiston first debuted as a solo soprano at the age of 6. With that beginning, years of hard work led to an accomplished singing career. But Tristan decided to give up the most precious thing a singer has. Snap Judgment.
I am starting today my radio diary, where I'm going to basically record my singing as it changes as I transition. And soon, I'm going to start testosterone and my voice is going to change. And, you know, at this very minute, thinking about that, it feels a bit scary. Feels like there might be some loss. My name used to be Ruth. That's what I was christened, Ruth Margaret.
Here's Ruth just appeared down. It's 10 o'clock at night. She's just going to sing the song for Grandad.
To a cowboy, all dressed in red, fell off his horse and fractured his head. Blood on the saddle. Blood on the ground, great big blobs of blood all around.
Well done!
Like, as a kid, every day I had battles for really quite simple things. Like, I can remember going to nursery school and my mother put a barrette in my hair, right in the middle of my head. The idea of walking up the steps and walking in to my nursery school class with this barrette in my hair seemed mortifying to my four-year-old self. It was just so upsetting, and I was like crying and crying, please, please, mommy, please, take it out. As we were, you know, walking up the steps to the nursery school, she kind of reached down and took it out, and then it was like, you know, the sun shone again for me, and it was like, wow, I dodged another bullet. When I was about 12, like, we were all playing football like we always did, and me and all the boys of the neighborhood of Lockerbie, and they were picking teams, and I was the last one to be picked, and somebody kind of reluctantly said, you know, who's going to take Chubbs? Who's going to do this incredible favor? Who's going to make the sacrifice of taking a girl? I looked over at my brother. All I remember is seeing him turn away, look really embarrassed, and that was it. That was it for me in, like, my boyhood. It was like a seam being ripped apart. You know, it sounds so dramatic, but it was dramatic. It was the moment when I really learned what it was going to be like to be me. That's it. I'm not a boy.
The water is wide, I cannot...
You know, and then for years it was like, wow, it's like I went to sleep. You know, I went to sleep and I was this boy. And somehow I woke up as a woman and I did not know who that was. And a few years later, I called my mother and had that talk with her where I said, there's something you should know, I'm a lesbian. And the first thing she said was, well, you've always wanted to be a boy. And I was like, what are you talking about? Who says that, you know, I want to be a boy? I'm a lesbian, you know. I was actually, you know, for a couple of years really finding something about being a woman that I could sort of relate to for the first time. And a few years after that, I was like, well, maybe I can explore the being a boy. And I did. It was like so wonderful to have this feeling of like another kind of coming out.
I do realize that you have really lived as a boy for a long time. So, transitioning doesn't really shock me.
And how did Dad react when you told him? You told him?
I told your dad, and he didn't really say anything. And once he did say to me, "I hope I'm dead before this happens." But it's something. It's out of our realm, really. We don't live where a lot of people are transitioning. Everybody we know's got, you know, kids and grandkids.
There was something about hearing that my father would rather be dead than to kind of live with me through my transition. It just sent me really to a real place of like, I'm such a freak. Like, what am I thinking? Brought up a lot of really old kinds of feelings about not being the right kind of child, not being a girl that they could be proud of. In a week's time, I will get my first testosterone shot. Yeah, I'm scared and I'm excited. At the beginning of any journey, a ship sets sail.
Okay, I'm ready.
At the point of departure, there's, you know, all this hoopla. There's like ticker tape and there's rice being thrown and people are cheering. And
okay, so basically I'm going to go into a muscle in your buttock. So I need you to take your pants off, just kind of drop them down to below hip level.
It's possible at the other end of the journey there'll be people waiting, you know, friends and family, and there'll be some celebrations then too.
Now I'm going to inject the testosterone in, and you might feel a little bit of a pinch. It shouldn't be very painful. Okay, it's all in, and we're done. How was that?
Good.
Okay.
But in between here and there, in between this shore and that shore, the boat just chugs along. It chugs along.
Oh Lord, to be with you, to be free.
I would say it was a little anticlimactic getting my first shot. I'd been waiting for it for a long time. You know, I guess some part of me maybe expected that, you know, I'd get my shot of testosterone and it would be like a thunderbolt or a lightning strike, and everything would be different and I'd be like the person I want to be. To be honest, I didn't feel anything at all. I got the shot and it was kind of like, oh, right, things happen slowly. They happen in a certain sequence and they happen over time. Just struck me in a real way that my voice is going to be changing. But it just really struck me. I don't have unlimited time with this voice.
To be free.
Can you hear me? Can you hear me? Home again, cross the sea. So it's just been over a month that I've been on testosterone, not really noticing any big drastic changes, but there's something changing in my heart. There's like a lightness, a sense that I'm doing the right thing. Using the public bathrooms for me, it's always been a bit fraught because invariably if I go into a women's bathroom at a public space, I get looked at, hassled, told I'm in the wrong bathroom. But I can be kind of like, oh, no, it's your mistake. There's a certain safety. I can sort of reach back and, you know, it's kind of like, well, if I need to, I can prove it. Up to this point, I have been continuing to use female bathrooms. And yesterday, it felt like today I can pass for a guy. So I went in and I just kind of swaggered in and there's nobody else in it. So I kind of felt safe. But then just as I was coming out, a bunch of men came in and I just felt a little bit scary, so I kind of washed my hands really quickly and just kind of swaggered out.
I am sailing home again,
across the sea.
My voice is breaking. The whole middle of my voice feels a bit like cheesecloth, like I'm singing or I'm talking and it just feels gravelly and holy, like I've smoked, you know, way too many cigarettes and drank bottles of whiskey, and I wake up the next morning and I'm like, hello.
Can you hear me?
I'm catching sight of myself in mirrors and I don't exactly recognize myself right away. I like what I see. I like the way my body's changing. I love the muscles. I love the broadening of the shoulders. My walk is changing. The way I smile feels like it's changing. There's more confidence in myself moving through the world.
Okay, so I'm gonna shave now. It's the shaving cream. So, I don't know who teaches guys how to shave, but I feel like I'm a little late in the game to be learning. I guess dads probably teach their sons how to shave. Or older brothers, maybe. I'm self-taught.
Haven't talked to my dad really since May. My brother, I've sent 2 emails letting him know that I'm transitioning and haven't heard back. I feel like I'm a bit of a, you know, I'm on a ship sailing solo through the sea. And, you know, I'm leaving people behind on one shore. And some of those people will be on the other shore when I get there to welcome me home. And some of them won't.
I am sailing, I am sailing home again, across the sea, I am sailing.
My voice is finally broken. So, mix singing, not that much fun right now. It's, makes me feel really vulnerable.
I am sailing, I am sailing home again.
Do you notice any differences in the way I look or sound?
Your voice is a little deeper. Look, you do look more masculine. You've got broader shoulders now. More masculine shape, more chunky. Not fat, but more chunky. We don't think any less of you because you're male than you're female. So.
Yeah, that's good of you.
Oh, you're still our kid, right?
Somebody asked me the other day, you know, if I consider myself a trans man or if I consider myself a man. And I said I consider myself a trans man because I bring with me those 37 years. 1 year on testosterone doesn't mean those years disappear.
Can you hear me? Can you hear me through the dark night far away?
It is March the 21st. Today it's April 20th.
It's May the 2nd.
It's June the 27th.
It's July the 11th.
It's Tristan and it's August the 18th.
This is Tristan and it's September the
23rd. This is Tristan
and it's October the 15th.
It's Tristan. It's November
Hi,
the 3rd.
Hi, this is Tristan. It's December the
10th.
Hi,
this is Tristan and it's April and I've now been on testosterone for 1 year.
To be free.
My voice, my speaking voice and my singing voice have changed quite a lot. And I've changed quite a lot. And I don't feel like I've changed at all.
Thank you so much, Tristan, for sharing your story with Snap. Tristan recorded an audio diary over the course of a full year. The piece is entitled Middle Sea and originally aired in Canada on the CBC. It won the Premius Ondas Award for International Radio and a silver medal at the New York Festivals. Middle Sea was produced for CBC Radio's Out Front by Tristan R. Whiston and Karma Jolly. We'll have a link to the full piece, as well as Tristan's other work, at snapjudgment.org. Now, with Snap Judgment, the Man in the Mirror episode continues. Dinner, like you've never heard before, and the best friend you always wish you had. Right after the break, stay tuned. Welcome back to Snap Judgment, the Man in the Mirror episode. Today, we're taking a really hard look at ourselves no matter the consequence. And I'm excited because our next story is from Tara Clancy, a storyteller we've been trying to work with for a long time. I am so glad we did. And she's not just going to tell you a story, no. She's going to step on the Snap Judgment Live stage in front of a sold-out New York 2,800-person-strong audience and tell you a story. Don't worry about tickets, parking, scalpers, and the like. We save you the very best seat in the house for Snap Live at Brooklyn's Academy of Music.
An amazing storyteller. We couldn't wait to get on this stage. Please put your hands together for your own New York, Tara Clancy.
So it is a beautiful spring day. Blue skies, sunshine, 10 o'clock in the morning, and I am in a bar. The kind of bar that, well, opens at 10 o'clock in the morning. You got me, you got me. So it's not the Ritz, but it's mine. It is my family's local bar here in New York. It is owned by my Uncle Sal, and my mom worked there when she was younger, and now I work there too. I am 21, and I'm a bartender. So on this particular day, it is just me and a regular named Joe Burr. Now, Joe was originally from South Boston, so he was like Goodwill Hunting South Boston, right? He was like Sean Penn, or whatever that movie was called, South Boston, right? He's like a Wahlberg, you know? He's got the jeans, and he's got the flannel, and he's got the construction boots, and I don't actually know what he does for a living, but I figure he's in construction because of the boots, but I never ask, and he never offers. He comes in. He drinks Budweiser, nothing but Budweiser, and never short of a case, with or without the help of his younger brother, Billy, who was a worse drunk, better teeth. Anyway, he's not there. It's just me and Joe alone. So my family's bar, it had like its upsides and its downsides, right? Like on the upside, like, you know, business is so good because we have so many regulars. And on the downside, you know, business is so good because we have so many regulars. These guys are there day in and day out, right? We got so many regulars, we got to give them nicknames, like, to set them apart, you know? So we got Big Joe because he's big, and we got Black Joe because he's black, and we got One Arm Joe because he actually only had one arm. We've got so many guys named Eddie that one of them has to go by Goiter Eddie. So we got a couple of guys who get nicknames based on the work that they do. So, you know, you got like Jimmy Ice Cream, he sells ice cream, and Vinny the Fish, you know, he sells fish. Now, obviously there's a lot more to these guys than their jobs or their goiters. But because they weren't exactly easy to get to know, even though people didn't know the first thing about them, people judged. And by people, I mean me. So like I said, I was 21 years old and I'm a bartender, but I was also in college at this time, which was not something that everybody, you know, I grew up with was doing. And so I was proud of myself. In fact, I was like a little too proud, you know, like suddenly I was coming into the bar where, you know, I had like this college walk and I had this like college talk, which is like exactly like my talk right now, except I sometimes use the word polemic, you know. So 2 hours go by, Joe is still there drinking Bud, he's still the only guy in the bar, I'm still there, it's noon, I order some lunch from the Chinese food place, the Chinese food delivery guy comes, he hands me the bill, I see right away that I have been overcharged, and I'm trying to explain it to him, but he doesn't seem to understand, right? He's like not a native English speaker, and between how fast I talk and my accent, like neither am I, and so we're just kind of like going back and forth, we're not understanding, and finally I'm like, oh, they probably charged me for two orders, let me see if it's two orders in the bag, you know, and I'll show him, and so I go to like to take the bag to show him, and he pulls the bag back, and before you know it, we're like doing tug of war with my pork fried rice, you know, and it's getting heated, and that's when Joe gets up, and this is not good, right? This is a tough South Boston guy, and I'm like, oh man, he is just gonna come over here, and he is gonna cold cock this dude. And without even thinking, I just like shut my eyes. But what I hear next, like shoots my eyes right back open. Joe Bird is speaking slowly and calmly and completely in Chinese. This man who just a second ago was drinking a bottle of Budweiser for breakfast. This man who I have known for years to be the same day in, day out, like the only change being a little more or a little less, like pee on his pants. This man is like rattling on in fluent Chinese, right? I mean, it's unbelievable. And they're like patting each other on the back now, you know? They're like working it out. They're doing that like everything is cool, bro, in Chinese, you know? And the delivery man trots on out happily, and Joe turns around, sits back in the stool, takes a sip of his beer like nothing ever happened. And I'm in a state of shock, right? I can't even speak. I'm just staring down at Joe. And so, thankfully, finally, Joe speaks. He says, "I sell pigeons." My mouth says nothing. My eyebrows say, what the? In Chinatown. And a couple of years back, I expanded the business to Hong Kong. And, you know, my brother, he doesn't speak Cantonese, and it really holds him back. I still got nothing. I got nothing. And he says, look, I know it's strange, but my father started the business, and it was all just an accident. That does it. Joe, I say, how the hell do you accidentally sell a pigeon? And he looks up and he's like, all right, look. 40, 50 years ago maybe, my father, he's driving through Chinatown in Boston in his pickup truck, right? And in the back of the truck, he's got all these cages full of his racing pigeons. He raced pigeons. It was like his hobby. And so he gets stopped at a red light, and a Chinese woman approaches him, and she asks to buy one. And he's a little taken aback, you know, and he doesn't understand. And he's like, well, I haven't thought about it. And where do you race pigeons? And she cuts him off. She's like, no. I don't want to race them. I want to eat them. To the couple of people who made that face. People eat pigeons all over the world, just so you know, right? I mean, you can go uptown right now to like a white tablecloth joint and they call it squab and they charge you $30. Don't judge. So Joe goes on, right? So he's like, look, so my dad goes home that night. He's like, maybe this is like a business opportunity, and his like wheels are turning and he's trying to figure it out. And so finally he has this light bulb moment. Street pigeons. And I say, street pigeons. And he says, street pigeons. And I say, street pigeons. And he says, street pigeons, kid. He's like, you know, they're free and edible, you know. You know, no overhead, tons of supply, you know, bingo. Their family business was born. And then all he says is, and you know, I just kind of like took it to the next level, you know, I started exporting. All right, now of course, all of this is like totally and completely illegal, which is why the brothers kept it a secret. And so what is the point? The point is that I am an idiot, and for two reasons. One, up until this very moment, I actually thought that Bird was his real last name. Jimmy Ice Cream sells ice cream, right? Okay. And two, here I was working in my family business also, but also thinking that I was ambitious, right? Like I was in college, and so that made me better than all these bar people I had grown up with, only to find out that these bar people actually taught themselves Cantonese so they could be secret international criminal pigeon dealers. How's that for ambition? Anyway, now that the secret was out of the bag, I got to know Joe a lot better. We kind of became friends, and not long afterwards, he took me back to his apartment one day to show me his apartment, and it was amazing. It was like filled with like jade Buddhas and antique bamboo furniture, you know? I had class. And then another time I ran into him in the street one day and he decided to share something with me. It was pretty amazing, so I'm gonna share it with you. He decided to share with me how you catch a street pigeon. Now they used cages, of course, but I guess if you need to catch a pigeon in a pinch, this is the manual method. Let's just pretend that that's a pigeon, okay, right over there. So what you're gonna do is it's really amazing. You gotta get like within a foot of a pigeon, which in and of itself is almost impossible. You gotta get within a foot of a pigeon, right? And then when you get close, you're gonna do this like one fluid motion. It like happens in like a split second, okay? You ready? Here we go. You're gonna go up and you stomp, they fly, you clap, bang, pigeon. Sounds easy, but it's not. I was just like this the whole time. All right, so I haven't seen Joe in a really long time, and he was a really hard-living guy, so there's probably like an equal chance that he has OD'd as there is that he is now heading a department for Google. That's Joe. But he forever changed the way I saw the world, truly. In fact, not long after he shared his story with me, I was bartending again at 10 o'clock in the morning, and again, it was just me and one regular. And this time, the guy was kind of sitting at the stool closest to the bar window, and he's drinking his drink, and he's looking out the window. And at that moment, another guy starts to walk by, and that guy, he's in like a business suit, and he's got a briefcase, and he's like very obviously on his way to the office, right? And the two of them, they lock eyes. And I've seen this before, but I had never seen it in this way. They lock eyes, and they're looking at each other, and I'm looking at them. And for the first time, I realize that they are both thinking the exact same thing of each other. And that is, poor guy.
Tara Clancy is a writer whose memoir, The Clancys of Queens, will be published by Crown in 2016. The music for that piece was written by Alex Mandel and performed by Alex, Tim Frick, and David Brandt at Snap Judgment Live in New York. See the video on our website for Tara's awesome performance, and you can actually see as well How to Catch a Pigeon. It's all there. Check it out, snapjudgment.org.
Tara Clancy, ladies and gentlemen.
When the Snap Judgment Man in the Mirror episode returns, I'm asking him to change his ways because no message could have been any clearer. If you want to make the world a better place, just look at yourself and make a change. Also, we get to fire up the Snap Judgment Space and Time Machine when the Man in the Mirror episode continues. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Snap Judgment from WNYC, the Man in the Mirror episode. My name is Glenn Washington, and today we seek the deadliest catch of all. For our next story, I'm going to have to ask you to put your trays in their upright position as we prepare to take off in our magic time machine across the pond and into the mind of writer Rebecca Adams Wright. Snap Judgment.
There's a car coming down the drive. The deacon is middle-aged, sleek and fragile as a bird with a white-tipped throat. I stand behind him, watching with my mother and sisters as he unwraps the great window. He turns back layer after layer of stiff cloth until there, like a handful of jewels pounded flat and thin, is a stained glass panel. I've seen this window every Sunday since I can remember. It hangs, or used to hang, I suppose, in the church hall, at the top of the stairwell that leads to the crypt. The window shows a man, shoeless, his arms at his sides, palms upwards, staring at a dark sky. As a child, the window terrified me. It looked as if the man was waiting for the sky to fall and crush him. My father told me the man was looking at God, who's trying to make me feel better. But when we were at church, it took everything in me not to stare at it and scare myself. The deacon rewraps the window, and my mother and I lead him to my father's stone tool shed behind the house. He leans it in a dark corner. He thanks us for our service, tells us the Luftwaffe don't have a chance of bombing it to pieces now. He shakes my mother's hand with both of his own. She turns her head and coughs quietly into her shoulder. I can see a little splotch of blood on the cream-coloured cotton. The deacon smiles, oblivious, and climbs into his boxy Nash. Soon, he's bumping down the hedge-lined road into town. My littlest sister, Rose, asks if the picture is ours now. My mother attempts a smile and shakes her head no. She tells Rose, but we must keep it very safe for the deacon. Then Abigail, 4 years my junior, asks mother if we can give it back when daddy comes home.
Grow up!
I want to scream each time she asks after him.
Can't you see how sick mother is? How much your pointless questions take out of her?
My mother nods, but won't look at us. We look down the hill, toward the slate roofs of the village. I see Rose take Abigail's trembling hand.
It's been 3 weeks since our mother went to the hospital. Abigail and Rose tell me my breakfast is terrible. I burnt the toast and the eggs are runny. I tell them they can't go to school hungry. Abigail pushes her plate defiantly, her breakfast untouched. Rose copies her. They pull on their coats and leave, slamming the door behind them. I run to the shed. It smells musty from the night's rain. I let the heavy oak door swing shut behind me and light the lantern hanging from the wall. I find the window and unwrap it. I've been coming down to the shed to worry and think almost every day since Mother left. Nothing changes here. My father's tools, a pile of chopped firewood, old rusting farm equipment. But when I look at the window, I see that the man has redirected his gaze. He's no longer staring skyward. Instead, he's looking right at me. My heart pounds. I back up several halting steps, ready to run. But he doesn't move. I stare back at him, trying to look braver than I feel. I see now that he's smiling, even as I wrap him back in the canvas. I come back the next day and discover the glass man has moved again. This time, he's walked to the wrought iron edge of his pane. The following evening, he's raised his arms skyward in a farewell wave. By morning, when I go to check on him, he's left the window completely. All that's left is an empty pasture, grey clouds churning overhead. Later that afternoon, I'm waiting in the drizzle for the sheep to pass through the gate into their shelter. I hear a shuffle. I look up and see him. He's the size of a man, made all of glass. He catches my gaze and smiles. I'm still afraid, but I see kindness in his eyes. He approaches me, reaches out his hand. It's oddly dimensional, flat and rounded at the same time. When the sun catches his skin, prisms of colour radiate from him. We shake hands. I'm not afraid. I feel, for the first time in ages, like I'm not alone. Now he's everywhere I am. He watches when I wash dishes and cook and garden. He stands inside of my bedroom window when I go to sleep, and in the morning when I unpin the blackout shades, I find him melded into the glass still, waiting for me to wake. I was curious one day when he didn't appear. I went to the shed and visited his window. There he was, in the middle of the glass, staring at the sky, a part of the picture again. My sisters don't seem to see him. I don't tell them about him either. They don't need another disruption in their lives. Letters from the hospital and periodic visits to her bedside aren't the same as having our mother at home. We hear nothing of Father. Before the glass man arrived, I was reluctant to turn on the wireless. News of the war tightened the knot in my chest. But one day, I find his sharply coloured hands have left gouges in the wood on either side of the dial. He must have taught himself how to turn the wireless on and off. Now, we listen to the BBC War Report together. We've just finished dinner. My sisters are throwing down cards in a game of Snap. I turn on the wireless. Static. I stick my head out the front door. The glass man is standing in the grass, just beyond the front stoop, staring at the sky. He's scrutinizing the dark clouds, looking for something. In the news this week, we've heard about the Luftwaffe dropping bombs across the countryside. Then he points to the dark clouds. I can't see anything. That's when the air raid sirens begin to whoop and shriek. My sisters jump up, scattering their card game across the rug. I pull them close to me. There's no time to get to the shelter outside the village. We have to leave the house. The lights in the living room and the kitchen will attract the bomber's attention. I look out the window, across the pasture, can barely see the outline of the shed in the dark.
Come on!
I yell to my sisters, grabbing their coats. We stumble out into the cold night.
Hey!
He's still standing at the side of the house, staring straight up.
We have to move. Come with us.
Abigail and Rose look at me, their eyes wide. They're afraid of me. Abigail asks quietly who I'm talking to. I shake my head, attempt to smile. Half running, half stumbling, I lead my sisters down the hilly pasture. We move through the tall grass, righting each other when we trip. We're almost to the shed when I hear an ominous buzzing. The sound goes louder and louder until I can't hear the siren. I turn to look for him and realize the glass man hasn't followed us. Instead, he's running across the field, away from the safety of the shed.
Stop! Stay in here with us!
But he runs further and then stops at the highest peak on the hill. Under the moon's light, the glass man's body glows like a beacon. He's the brightest light for miles.
No! No, they'll kill you!
But he stays there, between the plains and the shed, and spreads his arms. Abigail and Rose grab my coat then and tug me into the shed. As I pull the door shut, I can hear the dizzying screech of a falling bomb. The interior of the shed flares as bright as day, and a concussion of sound slams the walls. The ground shakes, and flakes of mortar rain from the stones. We scream. Outside, there's a burst of coloured shrapnel, and an explosion of glass splinters that strike the shed window like wasps. And then, the world is still. I stumble down to wrap my arms around Abigail and Rose. My ears ring. My throat is raw. After what feels like days, our embrace ends. I go to the window, go to unwrap the canvas. And I can feel it then, through the fabric. The window has been obliterated, smashed into a thousand tiny pieces. I can feel the tears come, hot and stinging. I turn to my sisters. They're waiting to see what I'll do next.
Adams Wright for introducing us all to the Glass Man. If you want to find out more about Rebecca's work and story collection, visit us online at snapjudgment.org. The sound design was by Pat Massini Miller. It was directed by Mark Ristich. The piece was read and produced by Liza Smith. It's about that time. But don't fret, don't frown. The treasure is about to be unlocked. There are over 100 full episodes of Snap Judgment Storytelling awaiting your pleasure right now. Just subscribe to the Snap Judgment Storytelling Podcast. Take the snap wherever you go. Snapjudgment.org. Pictures, videos. Did I mention the podcast? Hit us on Facebook. Like me on Twitter. Snap was produced by the team that never looks at itself in the mirror. Please say hello to the Uber producer, Mark Ristich. The thriller, Pat Massini Miller. Anna Off the Wall Sussman, Joe Jackson Rosenberg, Davey, Jerry Carroll Kim. The gloved one, Nancy Lopez. Renzo, Bubbles Gorio. The Get Fresh crew, Anna Adlerstein, Liza Smith, Leon Morimoto, and Matt Ducat. Jasmine Aguilera moonwalks to work every day. Did you ever lose track of where you put your pet chimpanzee? And by you, of course, I mean me. But don't throw around blame. Someone please check the hallways of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And if you see Snuggums, no sudden moves. Remember, likes pickles from the jar. Much love from the CPB. And this is not the news. No way is this the news. In fact, you could never come around here. Never see your face, just need to disappear. You could have fire in your eyes and your words be really clear, and you would still not be as far away from the news as this is. But this is WNYC.